Here, hold on. Let me use my Macintosh. How many minutes?
151.
So that's 9,060. And how many? There's a cut every second.
One and a half seconds. Yeah.
6,040 cuts.
6,040 cuts.
Yeah.
Nice.
So it's not a million cuts. It's not death by a million cuts, but it's death by 6,040 cuts.
Damn it! That's really funny.
I have been recording for 662 bars. So, any of our previous jokes.
How many cuts again?
6,040.
6,040. 6,040. Oh my god! This movie. Yikes! Yikes! Come at me, Birdman.
Now, see, that's a funny joke. That's stand up comedy right there.
So get together, have a few laughs.
Uh oh. Shit, lady, do I sound like I'm ordering a pizza?
Lady, put the freaking gun down on the ground right now. Take your shot across the freaking street and say it until he's gonna get you.
Hello, and welcome to Where There's a Willis, There's a Way, a film podcast about the multitude of works by Bruce Willis. My name is Josh Carter.
And I'm Kendrick Martin. Today, we will be covering Armageddon,
dun, dun, dun.
Directed by Michael Baywatch, written by Jonathan Hensley. Hensley?
I think it was Hensley last time we said it, because he's done another one, too.
Also, J.J. Abrams, Tony Gilroy, Shane Salerno, and Robert Ray Poole. If this is your first time listening to this podcast, what we do here is an in-depth breakdown of a movie starring Bruce Willis. Both from a film perspective and his individual contribution, we add the movie to our ranking, we talk trivia, and then we do the Wheel of Willis.
You can find all of our previous episodes at williswaypod.com. Find other podcasts in the Last of the Action Heroes podcast network over at lastoftheactionheroes.com. Remember to rate and review us on iTunes and tell everybody that you know about our podcast, because everybody needs a little bit more Bruce Willis in their life.
Including Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis, if you're listening to us, I know you love doing things. Give us a call. Leave us a voicemail. I will pay for a voicemail number just for you. 1-800-BRUCE-WILLIS if it has to be. You just let me know.
I'll give him my phone number. You don't have to deal with Kendrick's like weirdo thing.
Josh, I'm a millennial. I give my phone number out to no one.
Oh, okay. I see.
Before we drill a hole into Armageddon and place a nuclear bomb, we're going to give you an idea.
Never mind. That's fine.
Of what we think of this movie up top, and let you know if you should pause now, go watch and come back, or just listen to our suffering or enjoyment.
I mean, no spoilers, but this might be the best movie we covered on the podcast, just saying.
Of Armageddon. So we have patented a concept called the Bruce Willis rating system. We rate a movie out of Bruce Willis out of Bruce Willis.
Correct.
If this movie earns more than a Bruce, we think it's worth watching. And by that, you should pause and go watch. If it earns less than a Bruce, I would say don't go bother watching. Just listen to us. So, Joshua, Here we are, Armageddon.
Yep.
Some might say Bruce Willis's most notable film. Others might not say that.
Some might.
What would you rank this movie?
Kendrick, I am once again gonna give this movie a B for bees do not waste my time with this movie.
Oh.
Very
good.
Yep, a B out of Bruce Willis.
So that is the worst for those of you keeping score at home. The B is the lowest.
Well, asterisk, like, except for sub Bruce Willis temperatures, yeah. On the Kelvin scale, which is the Walters.
When you get into the physics, which this movie does not, You can actually have worse movies than just a B, but we encourage you to go listen to previous episodes for that inside detail.
Yep.
I agree this is a terrible movie.
Okay.
I don't think it's worth a B, though.
Oh, all right.
So I'm going to give it a BR.
Okay. real source of contention here right now. Yeah. It's like, where do you put it?
A BR.
Yeah. I think actually, maybe looking at the other stuff that I have on there, it might be a BR, but I can't remember. I'm trying to remember what I gave Color of Night, and I don't think our document goes down that far. But I would rate it around that. I think probably a BR. Yeah, I'll give this movie a BR.
So, yeah, the only reason I'm not giving it a B is I know there are worse movies, and because in order for this ranking scale to make any sense, it has to be a spread. Otherwise, everything's going to be...
every movie a B.
Otherwise, everything's going to be a B or a Bruce Willis, and that's of no help.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We're going to get our patent taken away if we don't kind of spread things out a little bit.
Yeah, the patent office is really cranking down on podcasts.
Oh, yeah. God, man. Big government. This is just like Orson Welles' 1984. Do you realize that?
Cracking down on
podcasts, big government.
Wow, I missed that chapter.
Yep, that was a big deal.
Yeah. We're almost to 2024. Do you think they're going to make a sequel?
To 1984?
Yeah.
I think they did. It was called 1985. A lot of people lived through it.
Oh. Yeah, that makes sense.
It was a big deal in the calendar year.
I thought maybe the 1984 Cinematic Universe was going to come out with more episodes.
Oh, I see. there was even a, prequel, a weird prequel. It was 1984 BC. I don't know if you ever heard about that one.
What was going on in that?
You know, the Greek government was getting out there. I don't know. I don't fucking remember what was going on that
Someone
time.
Someone was using papyrus to spy on people. I don't know.
Listen to my podcast, aka me attaching my words to a bird. Hope you catch it.
Dude, man, if I was in Greek times and I was podcasting by just constantly scribbling and then attaching it to birds, I wouldn't even use regular pigeons. I'd just attach to any bird.
Yeah, it's like a sponsor. It's like, we got a sponsor. It's a really weak bird with no left arm, so it's pretty easy to catch. And then other birds, it's like, oh, it's an eagle. Good luck. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're sponsored by pita bread or, I don't know, one of other Greek things.
So we just put our podcast into bake it into a pita bread, and then you bite into it, you're like, oh, it's a fortune pita bread, and then you open it up and you're like, why is it four pages on Bruce Willis? Who's this guy?
Wow, yeah, this we really went off the deep end here. And
I'm teaching an improv camp, so yes anding is like number one thing right now for me.
You should also teach a podcasting camp.
I really should. Can you imagine like a bunch of podcasters from Portland all showing up and then being like, all right, I'm ready to learn. And then they like take out their MacBooks and they're slowly tip tapping, typing away.
I just got I get a MacBook from work and it is a 2019 MacBook Pro.
Woo!
Not terrible. But it has like been going haywire recently. The Bluetooth stopped working. The power. I would unplug the power cable and the whole screen would just turn into like spaghetti.
What?
And I wasn't like hungry for lunch at the time. So I was like, well, this spaghetti's worthless to me. So I called up the,
the spaghetti factory,
the home office.
That's for a refund.
Yeah. I called the spaghetti factory and I was like, hey, I got an invention for you.
Can you
I
help me with my Apple?
I got a patent for you. No, I called up the home office and I was like, yo, can I please get a new computer? And they were like, sure, we'll send you a new one. So they sent me the 2016 MacBook with working Bluetooth. Although I popped it open today, did the old tippy-tap, log in. And it is like, warning, your battery is in real bad shape. And I was like, what? Why can't I just have a regular working computer?
You unscrew it and the battery is like a triangle. You're like, ah, that is a bad shape. Like, why is this not a rectangle?
Yeah. Don't be shapeless. That is from any size.
All right. Fair enough.
If you, dear listener, are still listening after all that bip and bop, and you want to get a hold of us, maybe let me know how I can get a working MacBook. Maybe let Josh know what kind of things are happening in Greece. You can send us an email, willisweypod@gmail.com. You can send us a tweet, @willisweypod.
You can also reach us on Instagram by tweeting at us on Twitter and then asking what our Instagram is. And then we'll tell you that it's willisweypod.
I post a lot of things on Instagram. I'm not a big Instagrammer, Instagramian, but I'm learning.
I believe it's Instagram cracker.
Oh, right. Did you know that graham crackers were invented to deter masturbation?
Really?
Yeah. I think that's one of those facts that is either true or false.
How?
I don't know. You just eat it instead, I guess. I don't know.
That reminds me of that one, like, old internet article where it's like husband and wife practice celibacy 2 years after marriage, and he's just talking about how he eats a whole raw potato whenever he feels tempted. It was like this whole thing.
I think you made
so
that
good.
Up.
Also, no, I promise I didn't.
All right, before we jump into Armageddon, we are going to take a quick break. I'm actually going to look up the history of the graham cracker because I've been saying that for a couple weeks and I'm not sure if that's true. Oh, yeah. Invented by Sylvester Graham. He believed minimizing pleasure and stimulation of all kinds, including the prevention of masturbation, coupled with a vegetarian diet, anchored by bread made from coarsely ground wheat, was how God intended people to live. His followers were called Grahamites and formed one of the first vegetarian movements in America.
That's why, like, the logo looks all like, I am against masturbation.
I've actually never seen the logo. It's just seen the Nabisco box. What logo are you talking about?
It's a guy that says I'm against masturbation on the box.
Oh, that limited makes total sense.
All right, now we're going to get into Armageddon.
Life is short.
I love you.
Love is forever.
Will you marry me?
Gracie grew up to become a full-blown hottie.
You're talking about my little girl, all right?
But you never know what the future holds. Until it hits.
It's a meteor shower.
This new one you're tracking. How big?
It's what we call a global killer. Nothing would survive, not even bacteria.
The United States government just asked us to save the world. Anybody want to say no?
You think we'll get hazard pay out of this?
They'll do it. They've made a few requests, though.
Such as?
Oscar here has got some outstanding parking tickets. Max would like you to bring back 8-track tapes. Not sure if that's going to work. Yeah, one more thing. None of them want to pay taxes again. Ever.
United States astronauts train for years. You have 12 days.
You stick that in me, I'm going to stab you in the heart with it.
On July 1st.
Tell me you've never let anybody down before.
I never quit yet. How's that?
Earth's darkest day.
How you feeling?
Good. Considering I've never been this scared in my entire life.
Will be man's finest hour.
I'm marrying you.
You bet you are.
Bruce Willis. Billy Bob Thornton, Liv Tyler, Ben Affleck, Will Patton, and Steve Buscemi.
Whoa! This is so much fun, it's freaky!
All the time in the world.
We have 18 minutes to zero barrier.
Is all they've got.
We all gotta die, right? I'm the guy who gets to do it saving the world.
Yeah! Do you think I'm gonna quit? We never quit!
Armageddon. A Jerry Bruckheimer production, directed by Michael Bay.
That audio was from one of the stupidest movies ever, Armageddon. I'm going to go ahead and read the description from IMDb. After discovering that an asteroid the size of Texas is going to impact Earth in less than a month, NASA recruits a misfit team of deep core drillers to save the planet. And you can find this movie on VOD or at any of your guy friends' houses who are ages like 28 to 40 in their DVD collection.
Wow, that's a deep cut there, Josh. Yep. I'm curious, how did you watch this movie? Did you rent it on VOD?
Yeah, I did. I paid money to watch this movie.
So again, I almost did, and then I realized last night as I was about to watch this movie that it is on cable for free. I mean, if you have cable. So okay. I use YouTube TV as a cable subscription, which is similar to a lot of other cable services. Mm-hmm. But the way it works is you basically just have an app called the YouTube TV app, and you search for whatever you want on there, and it pulls it up on the appropriate network. And so I watched this movie as if it were on cable TV.
Featuring commercials.
The reason I bring it up is, yes, it has commercial breaks, and it had a lot of commercial breaks. And I have not been using YouTube TV long, and I mainly have been using it for soccer games and the Olympics. But I have not used it for movie watching up until now. This is the first time I've done this. And the commercial breaks were pretty egregious, as were the TV edits for the movie. Though I don't know as to what extent the film was edited.
They probably cut out the F word.
Yes, you could tell that the language was edited. I think that the R word was edited into rejects at one point because it was definitely an 80-yard piece of dialogue, and I was trying to figure out what else it could be, but I wasn't sure, and I was like, that's weird.
Yeah, 34 minutes in, they do say the R
slur. Oh, well then, yeah, that was edited out, interestingly enough, to be rejects.
Yikes.
But other than that, I didn't, it wasn't, the commercials obviously took a lot away, although they were edited into scene breaks.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen this movie. I saw this movie when this movie came out in 1998 and didn't feel the need to be extremely,
picky about watching like the original director's vision or anything.
There's going to be a lot I want to talk about in this movie. Not a lot of it good though.
Do you even just want to get started with the stuff that we liked?
Sure. Okay. You go ahead. What did you like?
I actually thought that they did a pretty decent job trying to explain the character motivations of so many different characters. The team, you felt like you got to know the team a fair amount before they actually went in outer space. And I feel like that was decent. I liked that I got to know the characters a little bit. And I liked Steve Buscemi basically the entire time that he was in this movie. Although I didn't really like his character, I just thought that he gave a good performance. And I also really liked Billy Bob Thornton. And that's all the good things that I have to say about this movie.
So obviously this podcast about Bruce Willis, it's going to be a lot of action movies. Josh and I have talked repeatedly about how pleasantly surprised we've been that his repertoire of movies is much more overarching than I think either of us thought it was going to be.
For sure.
And it's been fewer action movies than I think either of us thought there's going to be. Although I think we're right now in 1998 is like where the action hero explosion, pun intended, sort of starts. And Armageddon being one of those. And I don't know if it's just I've been kind of spoiled by his other works, even his less action, more spy heavy movies that I found more interesting. But this movie, we haven't seen a ton of just straight pure action movies. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody knows pretty much what this movie is, unless, you know, you're like the tiniest of babies who's maybe never seen a movie before and you can barely talk and you're like, Mama, Dad, Dad podcast, and you put on this podcast, and you're a little baby, and you've never heard of Armageddon.
It would show up in the demographics, though, and that isn't the case. So.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I guess we would have seen 0 to 1 in our podcast listeners, and I have not seen anything in that. But this movie is obviously squarely an action film, and I think one of the things it does well is it captures you right away with action, and it doesn't really let up as far as action goes. And I'm going to have a lot to say about Michael Bay in general as we talk about this movie.
Yep.
But one of the things that this movie did was at least interest me. And I think this movie
interested you.
This movie was like visually interesting. And I think 20 plus years ago, the special effects, a little hard to say what, I don't know, 12 year old me would have thought or 11 year old me would have thought about this movie, but they're not as terrible as it could have been. I think early 2000s is right when CGI became a little bit cheaper, and you can tell now visually the difference in low res CGI versus a little more practical special effects. And this movie kind of leverages both to the effect that it still looks passably good. There's still a lot that looks bad and weird and unnecessary, but I think it's still passed like a brief visual inspection.
Yeah. For the time, especially, it's all right. Like the explosions are probably the thing that looks the worst. Yeah.
And then the other thing I was going to say, and you kind of spoke to this, is this really is an ensemble movie, and even before we did this podcast, I always thought of this movie as a Bruce Willis vehicle, and it definitely is because of kind of how his role is in this movie and how the ending plays. Mm-hmm. But this movie really has a stellar ensemble cast. Steve Buscemi is great.
Yeah.
Liv Tyler,
Billy Bob Thornton, Ben Affleck, mm-hmm. Owen Wilson. Like, none of them are doing their best work here, but they're all like interesting and unique and kind of fun to watch. And
yeah,
you know, there's a whole bunch of people I didn't even mention that are kind of interesting. And I was like, oh, this is kind of fun.
Like everybody seems like they kind of took their character and were like, all right, let's try to do something with this, even though they could have been like boring scientist guy or whatever.
Yeah. And I think with an ensemble cast this big, and there's a lot of people, there's like not even counting ground crew, there's two spaceships, and each of the spaceships have like 10 people. And then they pick up Peter Stormare from the Russian.
Oh, God.
They pick up Peter Stormare from the Jackal. Mercury Rising. He was in Mercury Rising.
Who was he in Mercury Rising?
He was a brief. So in Mercury Rising, last episode, Bruce Willis is on the run immediately after the hospital scene, and they get to the train, and Peter Stormare is in there, and then they have like a fight out in the train, and then he like kills him on the train. And I was like, because I had looked him up before that, and I was like, oh, we're gonna see him real soon, because I didn't want to like spoil the Armageddon connection. But
He gets introduced halfway through this movie, and he gets like a little bit of characterization type of stuff too.
So this movie could have definitely had basically like, you know, that I mean, like I said, there's two spaceships and they each have five or six people. They could have been 12 Blandos and then Bruce Willis easily, and then a whole bunch of red shirts get killed off.
And like, even though, I feel like a lot of other action movies are.
And even though a lot of people die in this movie, there's still like enough bits in this movie to kind of build a little bit of character backstory. Some more than others. I think some of those characters get kind of shafted, but
Owen Wilson, looking at you.
Yeah.
he like rides a horse, and that's his one character moment.
That's kind of like the bare minimum of what you would ask for this movie. So,
yeah. Like, you know, as far as an ensemble movie goes, if you're like, should I watch this or Ocean's 11? Fucking just watch Ocean's 11. Stop listening to this podcast and watch Ocean's 11 for the love of God.
So there's a great kind of write-up that I'll probably be referencing a few times throughout this on BuzzFeed by Sandy Rancadua. I'm going to assume is how her last name is pronounced. It was written in 2018 as kind of like a 20-year retrospective. There's actually a lot of 20-year retrospectives out there that are interesting and worth reading. The Ringer has another one. So I'll include this BuzzFeed one in the show notes. But she goes into a lot of the problems with this movie and really rips it apart. But even at the end, she's kind of like, but if it's on cable TV and I'm flipping through the channels, I'll probably watch part of it, which I feel like is kind of how this movie is for most of us, mm-hmm. because it was such a touchstone in our lives at that time. And it really ended the 90s. This movie was pre 9/11, pre financial crisis.
Very much so pre 9/11.
There's like the Twin Towers are very like visibly shown in one scene of the movie. Pre a lot of the things that the turn of the century had, pre Y2K, pre all this stuff. And I think it like for people who were alive at the time, it kind of it ended the 90s for us, and a lot of us think back to this movie, you know, the soundtrack and all that stuff.
Yeah, because like other movies like The Fifth Element, that takes place in the future, and then other things have different elements of other time periods and stuff like that. Like Mercury Rising feels like it's looking maybe to the future a little bit with all its cryptography and stuff, and The Jackal feels like it kind of could have taken place any time, which makes sense because it's a remake of an older movie. But Armageddon definitely feels like it was made in this time for this time, and that's it.
So that's about the end of my positive comments.
Yeah.
I want to talk about a couple different topics. The first I want to talk about is basic plot topics. I think it's fairly common now. If you're listening to this, you've probably seen memes. It's not a new concept about the ridiculousness that the whole plot rests on teaching oil drillers to be astronauts versus teaching astronauts how to be how to dig a hole and run a drill.
They don't know jack about drilling.
Yeah, there's a great Ben Affleck clip, which
from the audio commentary where he's just ripping this movie to shreds.
We may include here.
I asked Michael why it was easier to train oil drillers to become astronauts than it was to train astronauts to become oil drillers, and he told me to shut the fuck up. So that was the end of that talk. He was like, you know, Ben, just shut up, okay? You know, this is a real plan, all right? I was like, you mean it's a real plan at NASA to train oil drillers? He was like, just shut your mouth. See, here's where we demonstrate that, because Bruce is going to tell the guys that they did a bad job of building the drill tank. He did a piss. See, he's a salt of the earth guy. And the NASA nerdonauts don't understand his salt of the earth ways, his rough and tumble ways.
Well, that's because your cams are all
like, somehow they can build rocket ships, but they don't understand, like, what makes a good tranny.
We've had them training for 8 months solid now.
8 whole months?
Well, pretty much, yeah.
Oh, gee whiz. Well,
like, 8 whole months, as if that's not enough time to learn how to drill a hole. But in a week, we're going to learn how to be astronauts.
Oh, 1 whole week? Now you know how to fly into space? I need my guys.
Why do you need them?
They're the best.
Everyone's the best. Why are they the best?
I don't know. They just are.
I'm only the best because I work with the best. If you don't trust the men you're working with, you're as good as dead. If you want to send these boys into space, fine. I'm sure they'll make good astronauts. They don't know jack about drilling.
I mean, this is a little bit of a logic stretch, let's face it. They don't know jack about drilling. How hard can it be? Aim the drill at the ground and turn it on.
You think it's just drilling a hole? There's a lot you gotta know about. And when you're gonna break, snap off an edge in a tranny on a corner of a hot pipe, and you're gonna get a gas pocket.
Like, yeah, well, what about when the booster rockets don't fire and your EVA suit and your zero gravity, you know?
Didn't you see Apollo 13, boy?
Yeah.
I watched this movie and I was very frustrated at the depiction of science and physics, because I don't know about you, Josh, but we live in a society. No.
Oh my God.
We do. We actually live in an age of really good science fiction stories, and not only science fiction stories, but also like well-crafted space dramas. And I'll be talking more about one later potentially, but a lot of times I think space is shown more accurate. Like, it's hard to show space 100% accurate because there's a lot of nuance there, and that oftentimes eliminates storytelling. But you can definitely show accurate space elements without having to do a lot of explaining to the audience. And I think this
The show don't tell method.
Yeah,
of
this movie is definitely like, oh, space is just like air but darker. And and all the spaceships are just like flying like airplanes, and the way that everything works, they get to this asteroid. Even an asteroid the size of Texas would not have gravity this way. You wouldn't land like you would an airplane. Like Apollo 13.
I hate how they have fucking stupid little like wheels that come down and then they're like, yeah, this is how we're going to land on this planet.
Apollo 13 so fucking did a better job of explaining how space works. Like we don't need, like, yes, space is complicated and there's a lot of complications that involve, you know, orbital gravity and all this stuff.
That's why they made the montage though. Like the montages are made so that you could be like, space is complicated. We're going to explain some things about space. And then you like training, a little bit of explaining, training, a little bit of explaining, bare bones stuff so that you as an audience member can get it. And then you just show the rest.
Yeah. There was a movie recently, First Man, which, was about Neil Armstrong and kind of the landing on the moon, and it starred Ryan Gosling, and it had a lot of really good ways to kind of show you, it didn't assume the audience had to be totally explained as to how the math works in orbital dynamics and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It just kind of was like, look, it's complicated. You're up in space, but The thing is just like, I was like, these like spaceships, I don't know if maybe it was the 90s, but spaceships don't need to constantly be firing rockets. They're not airplanes. They just need to point in a direction and, you know, boost to a speed and then stop. And then they're like in that speed and then they have to slow down and do all this other stuff. And I feel like, especially when they got to the Russian space station to refuel, and it was definitely just like two airplanes kind of like merch stop and then like boop lost.
I so missed Interstellar when I was watching that, like Interstellar's like interlocking sequence how they had to like line everything up and make the spin exactly right, and then this movie's just docking complete. Like you might as well just have it be Star Trek where they just like load up right next to it and then go and like the little walkway comes out. Like it was that. It was so ridiculous.
And I know that this movie is in the 90s, and you know, even though that a lot of these newer movies and newer TV shows can shorthand this, it's because it's had 20 years from this movie to assume that the audience knows how some of this works. But Apollo 13 came out in 95.
Mm-hmm.
So well before this movie, and it showed you a mostly true story about space travel, and it included a lot of actual space drama versus this, which just had a lot of flying and fire and nonsense.
Yeah, Kendrick, I think The Fifth Element showed a more accurate form of space travel.
Well, the Fifth Element, The Fifth Element was the same way, where it had spaceships taking off from runways, but it did it in a way that it was like, look, this is absolute nonsense and nonsensical fun.
Yeah.
You can have a space shuttle like launch from a runway because it's going to another planet in, you know, 2 hours.
Yeah. This movie is like too stupid to be taking itself seriously and too serious to be taking itself stupidly. It worked itself into like a terrible corner.
So Michael Bay admitted, I don't know if at the time, but definitely later, he admits that this is definitely a fantasy story.
Mm-hmm.
So not meant to be taken serious in any science sense of the word.
Totally.
Which is fine. I mean, I think if I knew that kind of going into it, but I still felt frustrated because we've seen in the last 20 years great science fantasy stories that can still portray a little bit better space element to them, where it doesn't need to act like they're just fighter jets in space.
Yeah.
And so I think that ended up annoying me more than it should have.
Yeah, that was something that kind of flew right by me when I watched it. Like, I was just like, whatever, they're jets, I don't care. It's just one of the, like, it's not my biggest problem with the movie, but it is a problem with the movie. Because this movie has, like, so many script problems. It has so many, just, like, Michael Bay, you know, hating anybody who's not white. And so, a male. Like,
so let's talk about the Michael Bay of it all. I didn't take a lot of notes in this movie because I just kind of gave up at some point.
I took too many notes. I was so mad watching this.
Two of the notes that I took were the Michael Bay of it all, and then the conservative wet dream of it all.
Yes.
So let's talk about that a little
bit. Americana of this movie. So hoorah, America.
I don't have a huge Michael Bay connection. I've seen a good handful of his movies. I've seen like the Transformers movies. I've seen I'd seen this before. I had seen Pain and Gain, which is like one of known as kind of famously as his like lower stakes movie that I found was like really good. I've seen Bad Boys. I'm sure I've seen a couple others. I've seen The Rock a few times, but so I can't speak, and I don't remember this theme being as present, but this movie is blatantly obvious that it's kind of speaking to the modern day equivalent. And I don't know, again, the 20-year retrospectives will speak to this. So like those articles I mentioned earlier, but I don't know enough about 90s pop culture and kind of how this movie landed to know if it was read this way, but it definitely feels to me like the kind of propaganda that right-wing pundits or music stars use to kind of virtue signal or dog whistle to their mm-hmm. parties. Mm-hmm. And it was almost egregiously so. I think if I was like being marketed to this way, I would almost feel offended that it was so blatant and egregious.
Yeah.
So if you don't know what I'm talking about, basically this movie stars a bunch of blue collar workers who are repeatedly shown as being, you know, salt of the earth. They all work in like blue collar jobs in oil rigging, but they also their other occupations are like they own a ranch, or they drive cars, or they work on motorcycles, or they do something like in rural America that doesn't involve anybody else. They all avoid any sort of like government connections. So there's a lot when the gang is kind of rounded up, they make a big scene about how the FBI has to like chase people down in helicopters and cop cars and all this stuff just to like collect them to be like, hey, save the planet. They also, when they're putting this party together, like the thing they ask for, that's like the biggest thing, is like, we don't want to pay taxes anymore.
Yeah.
Which is like, I don't think any of these guys are that, none of them are that rich, and they can't be paying that many taxes. Like, their tax bill has to be very low.
Yeah, well, Steve Buscemi makes it sound like he's making bank on this instead of being like a scientist, and there's no way that
The oil industry is quite lucrative.
Do you think that they pay like their workers that amazingly?
Some of those oil rig workers get paid really well.
Because, but you're probably like a contractor, right? So
you do have a lot of like beneficial overhead. You're not making nearly what the owners of oil, the billions of dollars that the owners of these oil companies are making. Yeah. But still, oil rig workers do make a lot of money because it is a very dangerous job, and you do risk your life.
As they kind of show in this movie.
Yeah. So it is like a risk job, but still we're talking like 11 guys who maybe make,
let's say like 80,000 a year.
Yeah, I don't know.
We can look it up.
Yeah, oil rig worker salary. Top earners are 130,000. So this is in today's dollars. 75th percentile is 90,000. So,
and the average is 75,000.
Yeah. So that's
so pretty, let's say that they're all making at least 90,000 because these are supposedly like the top.
Yeah. So $90,000, your tax bill is like some of that, probably like 25-30%, but not a lot.
If you live in like a pretty progressive state, if you live in like Texas or wherever these guys are from.
Well, I'm talking about federal. I don't know state income tax.
I don't even know that it would be that much, because like the higher wage you earn, the lower percentage tax, effective tax rate you have.
I don't claim to be a taxologist,
a taxidermist, if you will.
A taxidermist, good one. But that is quite a low, like, you take the grand scheme of lucrative jobs. Again, the 90s, this was pre-tech boom, so this was like, you know, before your Zuckerbergs are making, you know,
unthinkable amounts
a year or whatever.
Yeah, you know? Unthinkable amounts of money.
Yeah, Facebook. People in the Bay Area are making, monopoly money level amounts of dollars. So there's all that. And then there's also the continuing theme of this movie is the incompetence of government, the incompetence of science, And the fact
and
that
how like the bureaucrats don't know what they're doing.
The fact that the bureaucrats, the scientists, the like brainiacs, none of them know what they're doing. There's like scenes where they're taking, there's like 10 guys taking notes on Bruce Willis just talking out his ass about drills.
These guys don't know jack about drilling.
Yeah, so this movie definitely has a message, and I think that's its message. And I was just so slapped in the face by it. And I think it's partly because of the fact that, you know, we live in an era where that marketing is so heavily focused. Like, you can't just make a movie and be like, we're going to make a movie about, you know, Americana. And because they never once really mention politics, like they never bring up
Democrat or Republican or anything they
never
like
bring
that.
Up, they never bring up political party, but they also never
bring up policies.
They never going to bring up who they're going to vote for. They never going to, they never bring up any sort of governmental level thing.
Although they do, Steve Buscemi does mention the like, it's crazy that we're flying up here on a rocket and like that's built by the lowest bidder essentially, which is talking about like how America doesn't invest much in their infrastructure, which is funny because they're like, we don't want to pay taxes. However, infrastructure is bad, which is just like a big complainer because how do you get better infrastructure? You spend fucking money. Like, this isn't rocket science, pun intended. So yeah, it's pretty stupid. But no, I totally agree with you. And like, if you're talking about a movie where like the everyday man, a working collar dude is like the good guy and the bureaucrats are well-meaning but don't know what they're doing exactly, Die Hard is so much of a better movie as far as that goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's not totally egregiously the essence of the movie. It's like an element of the movie, and it's not the like core principle. Whereas this movie, it felt like it was the core principle, and it felt like it was just constantly shoved in your face. You had no choice but to accept government bad, bureaucrats bad, like blue collar worker good,
so not
Greenpeace bad.
Not only are we continually reminded of the merits of, you know, the hardworking blue collar American and the stupidity of anyone who went to school or works for NASA or is in government or in the military. It really like shits on the military, this movie.
Totally.
Which I was kind of surprised because, again, you're looking at it through a lens of history, but nowadays a lot of conservative right-wing propaganda also includes them propping up the military as kind of like the thing to do. And this movie definitely doesn't take that route.
Even though the Air Force signed off on this movie. Like, they gave them access to a bunch of different equipment, and then they also were like, yep, gets the Air Force seal of approval. Because the Air Force, whenever the Air Force works on a movie, they get to say kind of what's included in the movie and what isn't. They also get final say over the cut. So they can say, nope, that scene is not in there. So like, there was a big contentious moment where the NASA guy pulls out a gun on Bruce Willis, and like the Air Force presumably wouldn't have signed off on that originally, but because the movie was already filmed at that point, the Air Force was like, well, it kind of makes sense within the character to have that, so I guess we'll sign off on it. But they could have vetoed that scene.
So I think the fact that the Kevin Bacon character kind of like comes around at the end, even though he's like an obstinate asshole for kind of no reason.
For conflict. This movie wasn't long enough. That was the big thing that Michael Bay probably thought. Is like, surely in 150 minutes is not enough time with this movie.
It goes back to what I was saying about a lot of other space dramas, well-done space dramas, is there is so much drama about space travel with failing systems and just the fact that space is so complicated and so difficult that you don't need a ridiculous, like, oh, I'm going to pull a gun on you so we can launch this nuke early.
Or I'm going to jump over a fucking canyon using my little rocket boosters.
Yeah. this movie is not only focusing on the conservative, like, Americana aspect and kind of downplaying any bureaucrat, any scientist, but it also definitely makes a America First mentality.
Well, I mean, the rockets' names are the freedom and the independence. Yes. And they say that it's like a joint mission with like the Russians, the Chinese. So obviously they live in like a multipolar world, which is cool and progressive and everything like that. If you believe in a realist form of political military might. But this movie like is saying, oh yeah, we're working, you know, across the world on a bunch of different things. And then it's just like the Americans doing everything. Like the Russians get included by accident practically. So yeah, it's so not, stupid. Yeah.
What I find so fascinating is nowadays in 2021, you have to, and other than private industry, so SpaceX or mm-hmm. Blue Origin, I think is what it's called. You have to rely on the Russians to get to space. So a lot of American astronauts have to use Russian ships to get to like the International Space Station or whatever. Also, it kind of blew my mind that this movie was pre International Space Station, because that to me seems like it has been around for so long.
This is pre-International Space Station?
Yeah, because they go to that Russian space station. And otherwise,
Wow.
So this movie,
didn't even click.
This movie is I would go as far to say racist, but it is definitely America, pro-America. And the obvious example using the Russian astronauts and the fact that other nations have equally or better space programs in America today make it hard to believe that no other nation would have been able to contribute much to this other than the one Russian space station, which when they get there is shown to be in the most disrepair. It's like duct tape together a space station that just constantly falls apart. Yeah, with one guy working there.
Yeah, that doesn't make any fucking sense.
It's just an obvious show of like everything's falling apart. And, you know, nothing works.
And they make so many comments about how like the Russian guy's bad. And, yeah.
They could have, like I said several times, you could have easily had all that space drama with the failing fuel pumps and the explosions and the like needing to leave really quickly. You could have still had all that, because that all happens normally. You don't need the most derelict of spaceship and the shittiest of astronauts to show that. And also 18 months would not be enough to completely drive somebody mad. People live in solo missions for years in, you know, other parts of the world. So,
and also that guy's accent was just so bad. He's like, I'm Russian scientist up on Russian ship. Actually, I think that might even be better than what is in the movie. I recently watched a movie called Top Hat from like the 30s with Fred Astaire, and there's like an Italian guy named Bedini, and then he's like played by a definite American guy that was born in Oklahoma and died in Oklahoma. But his character is just like, for the women, the kiss, for the men, the sword. And that's just what I was thinking of the whole time, is this is just Russian Bedini, just some American guy playing the worst Russian imaginable.
Peter Stormare, I think, is actually Swedish.
Oh, he is?
He's a Swedish American playing a Russian.
Well, his accent is fucking bad. It's not anywhere near the Jackal levels of bad, but it is so terrible.
So yeah, this movie has a lot of like problematic pro-America messages, but then it also just delves into the embarrassingly inept slash racist slash no one spent the time to do the research. I would not call myself any level of Eastern historian or philosopher or anything, but there is several scenes shown of a group of people at the Taj Mahal. The Taj Mahal is a burial site, and I believe it's a Muslim burial site, but I'm not sure. And the people shown praying at the Taj Mahal, which no one does, are Sikhs, which are not Muslims. So I was like, not only are they praying at a place that no one would pray at, when there are many other obvious
like holy sites or
holy
whatever
sites of Islam that they could have shown, you know, Mecca being the obvious one, but there are many sites, and or just skip that entirely. You could have easily just shorthanded "the world is praying" without this, like, just blatantly no one cared to Google anything in 1998, the pre-Google Google. No one cared to look anything up.
To load up a web page, log on to the FBI.com's website.
And right, then get their email for Yahoo.com.
Einstein.
So that was pretty offensive. But then, additionally, there's a scene where a whole bunch of asteroids fall, fall on Eastern Asia and kill, I think they said 20 million people, 30 million people.
Something like that.
And they're just like, well, that was a bummer. And I was like,
yeah,
30 million people just died.
They're like, when's that gonna, the big one gonna hit? Because we're concerned about that one. And also, New York got blown up. But how seriously do we have to take this? And like, the world also is shown as not taking it seriously until like that happens. But New York got blown up like at the beginning of the movie. I don't understand.
Yeah, they're trying to cover it up for a long time. But if they also, apparently, all people in Eastern Asia just live on boats in harbors.
Yes, exactly. That was amazing. Like, this happened in the South Pacific, and I was like, oh no, here we go. Oh great, they're all on boats. This movie also is not very kind to African Americans as well, because like the like one black dude that's up there is shown as like not bright at all, and the other African American guy that's in this movie is at the very beginning of the movie, and he is just like the most racist caricature of African Americans that have been on screen in a hot second.
Well, you're forgetting about Keith David, the antagonistic general.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so black people are either dumb or bad.
Yeah.
Love that. So, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, he's the general who kind of plays the "I have the nuclear button, I must nuke it right away" guy.
The president won't stand for this.
But you're also thinking of Michael Clark Duncan, who plays Bear on the gang of people. And he's the only white person, only non-white person on the group. And I don't know what his... he was most famous for The Green Mile, I think, in my recollection. I don't know what else he would have done before this, but he's like a pretty big guy, so he definitely stands out in this movie.
Mm-hmm. And that guy is so muscular, too.
Yeah. What, again, this movie, the fact that there's like, they even mentioned the fact that there's quote-unquote no weight limit when there's definitely a weight limit. Like, they can't just... They're not doing weight limits just for fun. They do weight, like the normal weight limits are because the freaking spaceship cannot get into space otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that no one, they're just like, nah, we'll just, you know, fill up the tank more. We'll put a little more gas in the tank, get it into space faster.
I'm trying to look up what else he's been in. Oh, he was in Cats and Dogs. God, that's embarrassing. Definitely have seen that.
It's embarrassing for who?
Me. It's embarrassing that I've seen that.
Yeah.
That's like one of my guilty pleasure movies, or it was actually. I have to rewatch it. The guy was in the movie called The Legend of the Kung Fu Rabbit, and then later he was in Kung Fu Panda. This guy's been in two animated movies.
He's got a type. Kung Fu. He's got a type.
That's so good. And he was in Daredevil later with Ben Affleck. Wow, look at him. Look at him go.
So, yeah, we haven't talked a lot about the Ben Affleck, Liv Tyler love story.
Yep.
So I watched this with my wife, Stacey, and she said that this was the movie that made Liv Tyler famous.
Which I thought.
I disagreed. I said it was Lord of the Rings, which is a few years later. But I don't know. I think when I think of her, I think of Lord of the Rings character.
Yeah, I don't think of this character, but I could see that this character kind of propelled her in the eye of the public. One of my roommates while watching this was like, her face, she's so beautiful. And
I agree. Yeah, Liv
Tyler
is great.
She's distractingly beautiful, and she has very intense eyes. I actually was like, is she wearing contacts, or are her eyes just like that intense?
Yeah, and she has like a very elegant presence. I'm like, it makes sense that she played an elf like a few years later, because, I mean, dang, she definitely has that sort of a vibe.
Yeah. She casts an aura. I think her character, obviously terrible in this movie. This movie does not do well with women. The only two...
Michael Bay.
The only two female characters in this movie are her and then a pilot.
Oh, yeah, guy's wife?
Oh, there's a... Well, there's a pilot.
Oh, right.
A ship pilot. Who they basically, they make a bunch of comments on how hot she is, and she's like, I'll crack your nuts if you keep talking.
Oh, I forgot about that person. I was thinking about the Driller's wife, who's like, oh yeah, this is my son, not your son. And then it's like, your daddy's a hero at the end of the movie, and then she's all into him because that's, you know, what makes a good dad somebody who's a hero, or a good spouse somebody who's a hero. That's so stupid. And then the other woman that's in the movie is Dottie, the person who's like, hey, I'm probably going to leave you. I don't think you're a good husband. And then he's like, go get the phone book, like right at the beginning. Oh, my God. I wrote down when that scene happened. I was like, guys, I think Michael Bay just hates women. I don't know.
Yeah. Grace Zabriskie is that woman. She was on Twin Peaks.
Your favorite show.
My favorite show.
Yeah.
And I was like, damn, it's her. She's got a very recognizable face. Also, there's just a ridiculous moment where they're like, he's like, I want to name the asteroid after my wife, Dottie. And he's like, that's sweet.
That's so
he's
nice.
Like, yeah, because she also would kill all humanity if given the chance, or whatever that joke is.
And she's a bitch. Yeah. Like, he literally says that. Yeah. And you're like, oh, my God.
Yeah. This movie is not nice to women.
And I hate how Michael Bay is like, whenever he gets critiqued, he's like, well, I'm making movies for teenage boys. It's like, okay. Included the explosions, I guess. Include the dumb plot elements, I guess. But, like, don't shit on women. You have a responsibility as a filmmaker and a person to, like, try to treat people decently.
Teenage boys can also have a normal relationship with a woman. But not only in addition to that, but you can also have non-sexualized characters a la Dottie just treated normally. Like...
I don't know about that, Kendrick. That's asking a lot.
Okay, it is Michael Bay, but still, you can have
no, it's totally true,
and also just regular characters.
Yeah, you can treat people just fine even if they are not sexually appealing.
Yes,
absolutely,
exactly,
absolutely,
exactly. All right, I feel like I've shit on this movie enough.
Mm-mm. Nope, I have more shits to give.
I'm gonna let you shit more.
Okay, so yeah. Anytime the president calls in, they're like, all right, the president's on the microphone. And then it is 16 different monitors showing the same angle of the president. What the fuck? Why do you have 16 monitors where you're showing the same person? And the surround sound kicks in whenever he's on there. And it's like, why is the president on surround sound? We know Zooms today have a hard time getting things to work. How in 1998 was the president up in Air Force One being on 16 monitors with surround sound? I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I won't believe it. That's the most unbelievable science in this movie. And that's saying a lot. Also, one of my roommates said that they saw a Letterboxd review that said Armageddon is a disaster movie in every sense of the word, and I agree. Also, even though this isn't our lowest rated movie, I think that this is my lowest rated movie per minute that you have to spend watching this movie, because this movie's 150 minutes long. For those of you keeping record at home, that's 2.5 hours long.
I watched this movie in two parts.
That sounds nice.
I watched it early afternoon yesterday, then I paused it and went and lived my life. And then after I was feeling good about myself, I came back and finished it.
I watched it all last night because I'm apparently somebody that hates themselves, and I wanted to watch it all at the same time.
Yeah, that sounds terrible.
Speaking of two parts, though, I did have this thought while watching the movie that this movie probably actually should have been two different movies. Hear me out. Because the beginning part of this movie, there is a goal of going up to the planet, or going up to the asteroid and planting the nuke. But there's also the goal of training up the astronauts and getting off the planet in the first place. That happens about an hour and a half into the movie. I very easily could have watched a movie where the entire goal was just to get these people trained and get them off the planet. And then later, another movie is about how they actually do the mission that they set out to do. And this movie feels like it really needs a break in it, because it's just so much, and there's so many disasters that happen of inconsequence. They get them figured out really quickly, or they're really stupid disasters that don't make any sense because J.J. Abrams doesn't know how to write. Don't at me, bros. Yeah.
And the first half of this movie, it takes them half the movie to get to space.
Yeah.
There's very few conflicts that really happen pre-getting to space.
Other than, like, Bruce Willis being like, I don't know if I like this Ben Affleck character. Yeah. I don't know if my daughter can ever be
a sexual creature because she's a woman.
Oh my god, I forgot about this because the rest of the movie is so egregious. But yeah, Bruce Willis's character is, like, so unlikable up until the last maybe, like, 10 minutes of the movie.
Yes.
Not his fault entirely, but annoying. Also, I haven't looked it up, but did you see why Bruce Willis did this movie? Did you hear about why why that happened? So apparently...
He was afraid of space.
No. So I read this on IMDb.
He's afraid of space bars.
Apparently, he was supposed to be in a movie called Broadway Brawler. And Bruce Willis was like, this isn't working. I gotta leave. And so then he signed a 3-picture deal with Disney to be like, let me out of this movie, absorb the cost. I'll be in 3 of your movies. And the 3 movies that he's in is this movie, The Sixth Sense, which we're going to cover soon, and Unbreakable, which we're going to cover in a bit. And he exited that movie in order to do this movie. And like, that was his stipulation. That was a stipulation from Disney, but I haven't looked up Broadway Brawler at all, but I'm really curious to see if it was like something that was going to be, like a more Hudson hockey, or if it was going to be, stupid. Cause Broadway makes me think that maybe it has some sort of musical element to it, but I have no idea. If you Google it, like one of the first results is a LA Times article from 1997, which is talking about how there's apparently a real life brawl that happened on the set of the movie.
It's apparently a family friendly romantic comedy set in the world of hockey. Willis plays the part of Eddie Kopinski, the titular Broadway Brawler, a retired hockey player romancing Mara Tierney's character, who did not even get a name.
Oh, bummer. Yeah, apparently he was like, this movie isn't working, I gotta leave.
Yeah, after 20 days of shooting, the production was halted as a result of Willis' dissatisfaction with director Lee Grant and the co-producer and the director of photography. Hmm. They were all fired, and it sounds like the filming never resumed.
Hmm. I wonder how much shooting they actually got done.
I don't know.
If I could watch any of it. Because that'd be interesting.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, wild.
Crazy stuff. But yeah, that's about all the shitting that I have to do on the movie. I obviously agree with everything you brought up. Oh, one thing that we didn't bring up is that this movie has about 1.5 seconds per shot of the movie. So Kendrick and I did the math earlier, and that adds up to about 6,040 cuts over the course of this movie, which is...
That's a lot.
Too many. And I watched Bohemian Rhapsody, so
I'm an expert sorry in that. For you, and also why?
You know, I really like Queen. That's my, like, downfall.
That's embarrassing, Josh. Okay, so we're going to move on now to the Star Trek Connection. Josh, why don't you riddle me with the Star Trek connections you have ready to go?
No, you do yours first. I'll bring in mine at the very end.
Right. So I have a couple low-level dudes. We have Andy Milner. I think it's pronounced Milder.
Andrew Mildew.
He plays the... he's a NASA tech in Armageddon, and he is in several Star Trek episodes. I think he's in Star Trek Voyager and Star Trek Deep Space Nine. He's also does voice acting for some Star Trek video games, interestingly enough. He's also in Apollo 13 as just a background NASA character. So he apparently likes his space things. A couple other side characters. We have Lawrence Tierney, who plays... he's a side character in a couple episodes of Star Trek. He's in Deep Space Nine. He's in Next Generation. And then he is...
Who is he in Deep Space Nine? Because that name sounds really familiar.
I just had it up in front of me. He is Regent in the episode Business as Usual.
Regent in Business as Usual.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go look up Business as Usual now. I just got done doing a watch through of that show, so I'm like, oh, I'm so excited about Deep Space Nine right now.
He plays the character of Eddie Stamper in Armageddon.
Interesting. I don't remember that character's name per se, but I believe you. It's the big bad guy in this episode. Yeah, that episode's great. Yeah, he's like an arms dealer, I'm pretty sure. Sorry, keep going.
Oh, that's it. That's it all I have.
Okay, so the one that you missed, the big one, is actually, if you look at the cast and crew, he is going to be down a few roles. I already gave away their gender. But
it's Bruce Willis?
No, Bruce Willis hasn't been in Star Trek yet, unfortunately. This character's name is Ronald Quincy. He's played by Jason Isaacs, who is famous for being in the Harry Potter series as Draco Malfoy's dad. But he also played Captain Lorca in Star Trek Discovery, which is our first Star Trek Discovery reference. Wow. So the first of the new Star Trek series, I'm pretty sure.
I think you're right.
Had. Yeah.
Have you watched Star Trek Discovery?
I have, yeah. So I've watched seasons 1 and 2. I'm working on season 3 right now because I got Paramount Plus because Beavis and Butthead was on it, and I was like, well, if I'm paying for Beavis and Butthead, I might as well get Paramount Plus. And then I've watched one episode of season 3, and I was like, that was kind of bad. I guess I might watch a little bit of it later. But Star Trek Discovery is okay. I wouldn't place it as my favorite Star Trek. It is not my least favorite Star Trek Enterprise. And I'm not going to call out which one is my least favorite, but it is not my least favorite. So yeah,
I've seen all seasons of Star Trek Discovery, and season 3 has a slow start, but I enjoyed it. I thought that it did. I thought it was a wise choice. We're getting Star Trek in the weeds here, but season 3 has a time jump from the previous two
seasons.
Yes,
it does.
And it also loses some characters from the previous two seasons that I found was a little lacking, but I think the choice was wise for the time jump. And the new characters in season 3 are also enjoyable.
Nice. Yeah. Do you like Captain Lorca as a character?
Yeah.
Yeah. I do too. I thought that he was a really, really enjoyable presence in season 1, and season 2 definitely felt like it was lacking for that like really charismatic role, because he is so charismatic in Star Trek Discovery. Season 2 did a really great job with bringing in Captain Pike. I think I would have hated season 2 if it didn't have Captain Pike in it.
I think they're going to have a spin-off show with just about Captain
Pike.
Yeah,
and I'm really excited for that. Like, I can't remember what that spin-off show is going to be called, like Strange New Worlds or something like that.
Have you watched Lower Decks?
I watched like 3 or 4 episodes, and I just think I'm not really into it that much. I feel like it's like a worse version of Rick and Morty, which I'm also not that big of a fan of.
Some of the similar writers of, so that would be why you might think that.
And it has like kind of a similar animation style.
Yeah,
I feel.
I found it very enjoyable, but I would say it's not super long. I think it's 10 episodes. Stick through it specifically for the final episode, which has a lot of cameos from Star Trek in general, a lot of voice acting cameos. And there is a particular line that is the right of the end of the episode that I won't spoil for you. But man, I loved that line so much. And sealed me on that show.
Okay. All right. Maybe I will watch it then, because they're also having season 2 come out. People are making a big
deal
about it.
Just announced season 2 stuff.
Yeah. They're making a big deal about a Tom Paris commemorative plate. Did you hear about that?
Oh, wow. No.
Yeah. So apparently in the show, they reference like, oh, this is a commemorative Tom Paris plate. And it's like just a dish plate that they have that has Tom Paris's face on it going like,
thumbs up or something like that. And then it gets referenced in the show, but then they made a real life plate that is that same exact
thing.
That's
great.
Yeah, that they're selling on the site.
That's great. I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Star Trek.
All right. Yeah, Star Trek.
Pretty
good.
Speaking
of Star Trek, we're going to talk about Bruce Willis's performance, I think, right?
Right after you tell me how much money this movie made.
Oh, man. Oh, man, this movie. So this movie got produced on a $140 million budget, which is, like, the highest by far. By far.
That we've talked about.
That we've talked about, yeah. It might be the highest overall. I'm not entirely sure.
I mean, Beavis and Butthead probably cost a lot, right?
What?
No.
It's $12 million, fucker! No! And this movie made $553 million in the box office. So its rate of return was 3.955. Still not as good as Die Hard with a Vengeance, and definitely not as good as Pulp Fiction or Look Who's Talking, which is 39 times the investment. There's nothing going to be a Look Who's Talking. There's never going to be another one. That was a crazy cash grab. Cash grab.
Okay, so let's briefly talk about Brucey W. Walter Bruce Willis. Like I said at the beginning of this review, this movie in my mind was definitely a Bruce Willis vehicle. I feel like he did not play as big of a role as I remembered him, but he still played a pretty substantial role. I think I liked how he definitely leaned into the leader role, which let the rest of the ensemble cast play the ridiculous, silly parts. So the fact that he was, you know, he's wearing the like polo shirt at the control booth, telling people like, yeah, pull the plug and do this and do that and make it harder on Ben Affleck and all this stuff. The fact that he's able to do that lets the rest of the cast respond and react to him, versus if he was also in the water. So I'm talking about a specific scene where they're in the water doing a test drill and Bruce Willis is kind of like talking to the tester saying like, hey, let's have some systems fail and let's try some different stuff to see how the team responds. The fact that he was kind of the intermediary there helped that transition, because like we've talked about, this movie is so hard on the scientists that it needed Bruce Willis to kind of be the go-between, because it was shitting on all the scientists, and then to turn around and be like, oh boy, actually we need these scientists to go to space would have been a big challenge. So he was able to be like, I'm Bruce Willis, I know how to go to space.
Yeah. Yeah, and I thought that he did a good job with his role. I said earlier I'm not really crazy about his character. Like, his character is shitting on, like, a green protest against oil rigs at the beginning of it, and he's like, he falls into that classic trap where you're, like, refusing to admit that something is bad because it is your job. And so he's like, oil's fine because it makes me a lot of money. And it's like, well, but,
not a lot of money. A decent amount of money.
Decent amount of money. Probably 130 grand, in today's dollars. So whatever that would have been back then. But yeah, it's kind of ridiculous for sure. But I thought that his performance was decent.
Yeah. He was able to, you know, play kind of like the gruff asshole. I feel like, you know, we've been talking about stereotypical Bruce Willis, and I think this movie is where you get that stereotypical Bruce Willis for the first time, really.
Is like, I don't think we've shown, had that before.
Yeah, it's kind of shown here.
Yeah, this is almost the same. He's a little bit more invested in this than he is in Cosmic Sin, because he at least gives us a little bit of emotion right at the end of the film. But I feel like you do get that gruff asshole character that he's kind of known for in this movie.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Okay, so with that said, Josh, where do you think you would rank this movie?
So, I don't like this movie much at all. I feel like it does a lot of really dumb action tropes really badly, and so I'd put it kind of in the camp of Color of Night and Mercury Rising, but I thought that it was a little bit more competent than Mercury Rising,
and a little bit less innovative than Color of Night was, which not to say that Color of Night is an amazing movie, but it's better than Armageddon. So I'm going to put Armageddon at 21, which will mean that this is the third consecutive movie to be placed at 21, bumping each subsequent movie down a little lower level.
Wow. Yeah, I also did not like this movie. I think I liked it better, though, than Look Who's Talking. But that means I would also put it, I think I'm going to end up putting it at 22. I'm going to bump Look Who's Talking down and put it at 22.
Mm.
Right below Billy Bathgate for me.
Yeah, I think I liked Billy Bathgate more than you did. But
yeah, you did. I struggled because
like
I don't I don't really like Billy Bathgate, but I didn't find it quite as offensive and egregious
as this movie. Nothing about Billy Bathgate. It's like, this is the worst movie ever. It's just like the most boring movie.
Billy Bathgate is just boring, correct? Yeah.
It's less exciting than taking a bath, which is, oh, get some nice hot water in a bathtub, and then you sit in it, and then it gets lukewarm, and you're like, I guess I'm done.
It's less exciting than opening a gate, which is like, whoa, what's behind this gate? I'm going to see some new stuff.
Oh, it's Billy. Damn it. All right. Enough of Kendrick and I making the worst jokes you've ever heard. Do you know what time it is, Kendrick? Did you bring your watch?
Hold on. Let me dig in my bag.
Shuffle, shuffle, shuffle.
Thank you for that sound effect. Here it is, my watch.
Oh my God. What does your watch say by chance?
It says, look at me.
What does it say now?
Oh, it says, it's time for the Wheel of Willis.
All right. Do you know what we say every time it gets to be, I'm feeling that drink that you fucking poured me earlier. This is your fault.
I introduced Josh to a Campari Spritz tonight because I feel like he needed to class up his life. I was like, Josh, you never know when you're going to be thrust into a boardroom of high-powered executives that are like, Josh, you got to go to space right now. But beforehand, drink this drink.
Drink this Impari or Campari or Empire. Drink this Empire drink.
Yep.
From the Empire of Italy.
Yeah, good job. Good job. I'm proud of you. Wow. So, what I'm trying to say in the long and the short of it is it's time for the Spin the Wheel of Willis.
And do you know what we say every time we spin the Wheel of Willis?
Every time we spin the Wheel of Willis, we say the same thing. And we say the same thing because we always spin the same wheel.
And the thing that we say is, whisk that wheel! Shoot, I should have taken a lesson from the Kendrickster and set it away from my mic. That's going to be really fucking annoying at it. All right. Could you take this movie as... This is a really long one, so I'm assuming it's from Nathan. Could you take this movie as seriously if Bruce Willis was forced to perform the entire thing with a ridiculous Italian accent? If yes, what accent would break your immersion? That wouldn't even be the worst accent in the movie.
Yeah, so the fact is that we have a pretty bad Russian accent.
Mm-hmm.
I think I could probably do okay with this movie. Did you watch Black Widow by chance?
I did, yes.
So there's a lot of Russian accents in that movie.
Yep.
And they're not...
God bless you, David Harbour, but your Russian accent is bad.
Both David Harbour and Florence Pugh have Russian accents in this movie that I found to be hilarious, but not offensive. Like, I was not... Also, Rachel Weisz, I guess, has her accent in the movie.
But hers was, like, less bad, I felt.
Scarlett Johansson somehow learned not to have an accent anymore.
We're not gonna same thing with Scarlet Witch. She like loses her accent after that first movie.
Well, she just magicked it away.
Yep.
I found those accents a little distracting, but also in a hilarious sense.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how this movie would have done if it had those same accents.
But Jack, you don't know the first thing about adrenaline.
It's me, adrenaline.
And you think that you're gonna teach these people how to drill? Like, imagine that.
They've only been learning a drilling for 8 months. I've been learning for 2 lifetimes.
My grandfather and his father before him were drillers.
I apologize to all Italian listeners. It goes well with our Campari we've been drinking. I feel like Josh just really ruined all sort of breakthroughs we had in that part of the world.
I mean, we talked about like all these different things that Michael Bay did egregiously. We're like, yeah, he's really bad, you know, with like other ethnicities and stuff. And then I'm just over here fucking being like a 1985 Mario movie on it. Yeah, you know, I think that this movie didn't actually, you
do
know,
good.
Do good in the first place, so no amount of bad Italian accent would take me out of this movie any more than this movie being bad took me out of this movie.
I think if Bruce Willis had a weird accent the whole time, but it was never explained. Like, he was just a roughneck oil drigger, but he talked like Mario.
Did you just say an oil drigger?
Yeah, that's what it's called, oil drigger. Oil rig driller. That's shortened to oil drigger.
We're hitting the diminishing returns portion of our podcast. Oh, God. Oh, my God. All right. All right. Cool, cool. Cool. All right, great. If somehow you want to rate us on Rotten Tomatoes, too bad. If you want to rate us on Apple Podcasts, you can load up the Apple Podcast website by Googling "where there's a Willis, there's a way," and then it will pop up, and then you can write in your review.
If you want to send us an email, send us a correction, maybe offer your inputs on our accents, you're welcome to do that. WillisWayPod@gmail.com. Find us on social medias at WillisWayPod.
Kendrick, we've started a thing where we kind of are trying to end every single episode with just a little bit of advice or a recommendation. What is your recommendation?
So I had one in mind earlier, but then I thought, you know, I'm going to recommend a better space story than Armageddon is. So another Apple TV Plus TV show. Last time I recommended Ted Lasso, but I'm also going to recommend the show For All Mankind.
Ah, that's written by Ronald D. Moore, one of the writers on Star Trek Next Generation and Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
The basic plot premise of this TV show is it is a loose sci-fi fantasy story set the first season, which is all I've seen. There are two seasons. The first season is set in the kind of the 60s through the 80s, and it's told from a story where the Soviets are the first people to make it to the moon, and the U.S. is kind of embarrassed because the Soviet space program continues to show them up. And so the U.S. has to kind of continually make advancements, and they end up trying to build a base on the moon, and then there's other like fast forwarding of space. The space race can kind of continues. There is a lot of interesting things about that first season that I feel like is too much to kind of describe right now. But one of the things I loved was its depiction of space travel and how it's only a 10 episode show, but it definitely is one of those things I talked about that really shows you how harrowing space travel can be and how different from just things on Earth are. So that is For All Mankind on Apple TV.
Great. Yeah. I watched like the first episode and I liked it enough, but then I canceled Paramount Plus at that point and I haven't, or not Paramount Plus. No, this Apple is on TV. Apple. But yeah, I haven't gone back and rewatched it basically. But yeah, I liked the first episode well enough. I thought that it was a little bit like reading a Wikipedia article that was acted out and less like watching a real life story. I didn't really feel that connected to the characters, but, you know, maybe I'll have to give it a second shot. As far as my recommendation goes, my recommendation is to close your Facebook. Just, you know, live life a little bit more. Stop reading your notifications. Stop getting sad when people are making mean comments on your feed. Just, you know, deactivate that because it's a slot machine for your brain and it's not good for you. So my recommendation is to close your Facebook app.
Josh, how can I win the lottery if I close the slot machine for my brain?
You win by enjoying life as God intended. You know, touching grass and shit.
Touching grass and shit. That actually sounds a lot better than Facebook, so I'm with you there.
Yep.
Well, thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this episode of Where There's a Willis, There's a Way. Josh, do you know what we're going to be talking about next time?
Next time, we're going to be covering... You just wrote down asterisk, so I feel like you're setting me up here.
That's why I asked you, because I didn't write it down while we're going to be talking
about. Are we covering The Siege?
We're talking about The Siege!
Next episode, we're covering The Siege!
How else will I attack your base but to siege it? I don't know. I had to ask. I don't know. How else?
I don't know. I don't have any other ideas. Ask the Greeks, I guess.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you want to follow me on Twitter for some reason, you can do that. At K Martinix.
And if you want to follow me, you can search up Joshing Carter.
Search up. Thanks everybody for having the patience to listen to us.
Goodbye.
Oh yes, it's fun time.
Explain this to me.
So this is sparkling wine.
Okay.
It's like American champagne.
Okay.
So that's all that is.
And then that one.
This is Campari. My favorite. They call them... I don't know how much into cocktails you are.
Mm-mm.
They call these aperitivos or amaros. Mm. Basically what there are is like a secret recipe of herbs and spices.
Mm.
And... in France and Italy and other Mediterranean countries, you have a spritz. The Campari is the more bitter of the ones, so it's like less palatable. But it was all I had at home, so
mm-hmm.
apologies. But Aperol, more popular, sweeter, similar mystery flavored. But you basically make a spritz, which is a little bit of this and then sparkling wine. So... champagne, prosecco, whatever, and then usually if you have it, a little bit of just seltzer water on top. But this is what I'll normally do. But then you can also just drink sparkling wine by itself. I just diluted down the remainder of my spritz with the rest of that sparkling wine. So
yeah,
feel free to do that. It's just regular sparkling wine.
Okay, and then tell me how again this relates into the Armageddon movie, because you said that it ties in.
No, it doesn't.
Oh, I was kidding. I was hoping that you were going to BS some way about that. Yeah, so they have to spritz their ship up to the moon and spritz around
Bruce
the moon.
Bruce Willis had to get really spritzed up for this for this thing.
I read that apparently he like negotiated in his contract that he got like a $175,000 trailer that's like a workout trailer for a Bruce secondary Willis. Trailer. Yeah, and then he never used it. Like, it had a full-size, like, full workable gym inside of it, and then he just didn't touch it at all.
Oh. I thought you meant, like, a movie trailer. And I was like, what the fuck would that be? Just a trailer for the movie where Bruce Willis is working out?
Yeah. Come watch Armageddon featuring Bruce Willis.
apparently, Ben Affleck had to get real sexed up for this movie.
Uh-huh.
And
did you see that he had to get new teeth?
Yeah. He had to get new teeth, but he also, there was a couple scenes they filmed of just people pouring water over him, and he's like, I don't know what that was for, but we just made me look sexy, I guess.
Oh, God. And they apparently added in, like, all of those romantic, like, subplot things, like, after Titanic came out. And then they, like, rewrote all of those in there, basically.
Wow, that's sad. That was, like, my favorite part of the movie.
Yep.
Because it was the only not terrible part.
All right, yeah. Anyway, so we're going to get into it.
Josh, I'm really glad that we came to record today. Do you know why?
Why?
Because I wouldn't want to miss a thing.
Kendrick, you're bringing in those sweet emotions right now.
Yeah. There's another needle drop that I can't remember, or I would also bring that up.
All right, time to go look up the soundtrack real quick.